This is Audible.
Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Ella Enchanted by Gail Carson Levine. Chapter 1. That fool of a fairy Lucinda did not intend to lay a curse on me. She meant to bestow a gift. When I cried inconsolably through my first hour of life, my tears were her inspiration. Shaking her head sympathetically at Mother, the fairy touched my nose. My gift is obedience. Ella will always be obedient. Now, stop crying, child. I stopped. Father was away on a trading expedition as usual, but our cook Mandy was there. She and Mother were horrified, but no matter how they explained it to Lucinda, they couldn't make her understand the terrible thing she'd done to me. I could picture the argument. Mandy's freckles standing out sharper than usual, her frizzy gray hair in disarray, and her double chin shaking with anger. Mother still and intense, her brown curls damp from labor, the laughter gone from her eyes. I couldn't imagine Lucinda. I didn't know what she looked like. She wouldn't undo the curse. My first awareness of it came on my 5th birthday. I seem to remember that day perfectly, perhaps because Mandy told the tale so often. "For your birthday," she'd start, "I baked a beautiful cake, 6 layers. Bertha, our head maid, had sewn a special gown for me. Blue as midnight, with a white sash. You were small for your age even then, and you looked like a china doll with a white ribbon in your black hair and your cheeks red from excitement. In the middle of the table was a vase filled with flowers that Nathan, our manservant, had picked. We all sat around the table. Father was away again. I was thrilled. I had watched Mandy bake the cake and Bertha sew the gown, and Nathan picked the flowers. Mandy cut the cake. When she handed me my piece, she said, without thinking, "Eat." The first bite was delicious. I finished the slice happily. When it was gone, Mandy cut another. That one was harder. When it was gone, no one gave me more, but I knew I had to keep eating. I moved my fork into the cake itself. "Ella, what are you doing?" Mother said. "Little piggy," Mandy laughed. "It's her birthday, lady. Let her have as much as she wants." She put another slice on my plate. I felt sick and frightened. Why couldn't I stop eating? Swallowing was a struggle. Each bite weighed on my tongue and felt like a sticky mass of glue as I fought to get it down. I started crying while I ate. Mother realized first. "Stop eating, Ella," she commanded. I stopped. Anyone could control me with an order. It had to be a direct command, such as "put on a shawl" or "you must go to bed now." A wish or a request had no effect. I was free to ignore, "I wish you would put on a shawl," or "why don't you go to bed now?" But against an order, I was powerless. If someone told me to hop on 1 foot for a day and a half, I'd have to do it. And hopping on 1 foot wasn't the worst order I could be given. If you commanded me to cut off my own head, I'd have to do it. I was in danger at every moment. As I grew older, I learned to delay my obedience, but each moment cost me dear. In breathlessness, nausea, dizziness, and other complaints, I could never hold out for long. Even a few minutes were a desperate struggle. I had a fairy godmother, and Mother asked her to take the curse away, but my fairy godmother said Lucinda was the only one who could remove it. However, she also said it might be broken someday, without Lucinda's help. But I didn't know how. I didn't even know who my fairy godmother was. Instead of making me docile, Lucinda's curse made a rebel of me, or perhaps I was that way naturally. Mother rarely insisted I do anything. Father knew nothing of the curse and saw me too infrequently to issue many commands. But Mandy was bossy, giving orders almost as often as she drew breath. Kind orders, or "for your own good" orders. "Bundle up, Ella," or "hold this bowl while I beat the egg, sweet." I disliked these commands, harmless as they were. I'd hold the bowl, but move my feet so she would have to follow me around the kitchen. She'd call me Minx and try to hem me in with more specific instructions, which I would find new ways to evade. Often it was a long business to get anything done between us, with Mother laughing and egging each of us on by turn. We'd end happily, with me finally choosing to do what Mandy wanted, or with Mandy changing her order to a request. When Mandy would absent-mindedly give me an order I knew she didn't mean, I'd say, "Do I have to?" And she'd reconsider. When I was 8, I had a friend, Pamela, the daughter of one of the servants. One day she and I were in the kitchen, watching Mandy make marchpane. When Mandy sent me to the pantry for more almonds, I returned with only 2. She ordered me back with more exact instructions, which I followed exactly while still managing to frustrate her true wishes. Later, when Pamela and I retreated to the garden to devour the candy, she asked why I hadn't done what Mandy wanted straight off. "I hate when she's bossy," I answered. Pamela said smugly, "I always obey my elders." "That's because you don't have to." "I do have to, or Father will slap me. It's not the same as for me. I'm under a spell." I enjoyed the importance of the words. Spells were rare. Lucinda was the only fairy rash enough to cast them on people. "Like Sleeping Beauty? Except I won't have to sleep for 100 years. What's your spell?" I told her. "If anybody gives you an order, you have to obey? Including me?" I nodded. "Can I try it?" "No!" I hadn't anticipated this. I changed the subject. "I'll race you to the gate." "All right, but I command you to lose the race." "Then I don't want to race. I command you to race, and I command you to lose." We raced. I lost. We picked berries. I had to give Pamela the sweetest, ripest ones. We played princesses and ogres. I had to be the ogre. An hour after my admission, I punched her. She screamed and blood poured from her nose. Our friendship ended that day. Mother found Pamela's mother a new situation far from our town of Frel. After punishing me for using my fist, Mother issued one of her infrequent commands, never to tell anyone about my curse. But I wouldn't have anyway. I had learned caution. When I was almost 15, Mother and I caught cold. Mandy dosed us with her curing soup, made with carrots, leeks, celery, and hair from a unicorn's tail. It was delicious, but we both hated to see those long yellow-white hairs floating around the vegetables. Since Father was away from Frel, we drank the soup sitting up in Mother's bed. If he had been home, I wouldn't have been in her room at all. He didn't like me to be anywhere near him, getting underfoot, as he said. I sipped my soup with the hairs in it because Mandy had said to, even though I grimaced at the soup and at Mandy's retreating back. "I'll wait for mine to cool," Mother said. Then after Mandy left, she took the hairs out while she ate and put them back in the empty bowl when she was done. The next day I was well, and Mother was much worse. Too sick to drink or eat anything. She said there was a knife in her throat and a battering ram at her head. To make her feel better, I put cool cloths on her forehead and told her stories. They were only old, familiar tales about the fairies that I changed here and there, but sometimes I made Mother laugh. Except the laugh would turn into a cough. Before Mandy sent me off for the night, Mother kissed me. "Good night. I love you, precious." They were her last words to me. As I left the room, I heard her last words to Mandy. "I'm not very sick. Don't send for Sir Peter." Sir Peter was Father. The next morning, she was awake, but dreaming. With wide-open eyes, she chattered to invisible courtiers and plucked nervously at her silver necklace. To Mandy and me, there in the room with her, she said nothing. Nathan, the manservant, got the physician, who hurried me away from Mother's side. Our hallway was empty. I followed it to the spiral staircase and walked down, remembering the times Mother and I had slid down the banister. "We didn't do it when people were around. We have to be dignified," she would whisper then, stepping down the stairs in an especially stately way. And I would follow, mimicking her and fighting my natural clumsiness, pleased to be part of her game. But when we were alone, we preferred to slide and yell all the way down and run back up for another ride, and a third, and a fourth. When I got to the bottom of the stairs, I pulled our heavy front door open and slipped out into the bright sunshine. It was a long walk to the old castle, but I wanted to make a wish, and I wanted to make it in the place where it would have the best chance of being granted. The castle had been abandoned when King Gerald was a boy, although it was reopened on special occasions, for private balls, weddings, and the like. Even so, Bertha said it was haunted, and Nathan said it was infested with mice. Its gardens were overgrown, but Bertha swore the candle trees had power. I went straight to the candle grove. The candles were small trees that had been pruned and tied to wires to make them grow in the shape of candelabra. For wishes, you need trading material. I closed my eyes and thought, if Mother gets well quick, I'll be good, not just obedient. I'll try harder not to be clumsy, and I won't tease Mandy so much. I didn't bargain for Mother's life, because I didn't believe she was in danger of dying. Chapter 2
Leaving behind a grieving husband and child, we must comfort them.
High Chancellor Thomas wound down after droning on for almost an hour. Some of his speech had been about Mother. At least the words Lady Eleanor were spoken often. But the person they described, dutiful parent, loyal citizen, steadfast spouse, sounded more like the High Chancellor than like my mother. Part of the speech had been about dying, but more was about giving allegiance to Curia and its rulers, King Gerald, Prince Charmant, and the entire royal family. Father reached for my hand. His palm was moist and hot as a hydra's swamp. I wished I had been allowed to stand with Mandy and the other servants. I pulled out of his grasp and moved a step away. He closed the distance between us and took my hand again. Mother's casket was made of gleaming mahogany, carved with designs of fairies and elves. If only the fairies could leap out of the wood and cast a spell to bring her back to life, and another one to send Father away. Or maybe my fairy godmother would do it, if I knew where to find her. When the High Chancellor finished, it was my task to close the casket so Mother could be lowered into her grave. Father put his hands on my shoulders and pushed me forward. Mother's mouth was stern, the opposite of its look in life, and her face was empty, which was awful. But worse was the creak as the coffin lid went down and the dry click when it closed, and the thought of Mother packed away in a box. The tears I had swallowed all day erupted. I stood there before the whole court, crying in an infant's endless wail, unable to stop myself. Father pressed my face into his chest. Perhaps he appeared to be comforting me, but he was only trying to muffle my noise, which couldn't be muffled. He let me go. In a sharp whisper, he said, "Get away from here. Come back when you can be quiet." For once, I was glad to obey. I ran. My heavy black gown tripped me and I fell. Before anyone could help me, I was off again, my knee and hands stinging. The biggest tree in the graveyard was a weeping willow, a crying tree. I plunged through its leaves and threw myself down sobbing. Everyone called it losing Mother, but she wasn't lost. She was gone, and no matter where I went, another town, another country, fairyland or gnome caverns, I wouldn't find her. We'd never talk again, or laugh together, or swim in the river Lucarno, or slide down the banister or play tricks on Bertha or a million things. I cried myself out and sat up. My gown had changed in front from black silk to brown dirt. As Mandy would have said, I was a spectacle. How much time had gone by? I had to go back. Father had told me to, and the curse was tugging at me to obey. Outside the privacy of my tree, Prince Charmant stood, reading a tombstone. I had never been so near him before. Had he heard me cry? Although the prince was only 2 years older than I, he was much taller, and he stood just like his father, feet apart, hands behind his back, as though the whole country were passing by on review. He looked like his father, too, although the sharp angles of King Gerald's face were softened in his son. They each had tawny curls and swarthy skin. I had never been near enough to the king to know whether he also had a sprinkling of freckles across his nose, surprising on such a dark face.
"Cousin of mine," the prince said, gesturing at the tombstone. "Never liked him."
I liked your mother.
He started walking back toward her tomb. Did he expect me to come with him? Was I supposed to maintain a suitable distance from his royal self? With enough room for a carriage to pass between us, I walked at his side. He moved closer. I saw he had been crying too, although he had stayed upright and clean.
You can call me Char, he told me suddenly. Everyone else does.
I could? We walked in silence.
My father calls me Char, too, he added.
The king! Thank you, I said.
Thank you, Char, he corrected.
Then,
your mother used to make me laugh. Once at a banquet, Chancellor Thomas was making a speech. While he talked, your mother moved her napkin around. I saw it before your father crumpled it up. She had arranged the edge in the shape of the Chancellor's profile, with the mouth open and the chin stuck out. It would have looked exactly like him if he were the color of a blue napkin. I had to leave without dinner so I could go outside and laugh.
We were halfway back. It was starting to rain. I could make out one figure, small in the distance, standing by Mother's grave. Father. Where did everyone go? I asked Char.
They all left before I came to find you, he said.
Did you want them to wait? He sounded worried, as if perhaps he should have made them stay. No, I didn't want any of them to wait, I answered, meaning Father could have gone too.
I know all about you,
Char announced, after we'd taken a few more steps. You do? How could you?
Your cook and our cook meet at the market. She talks about you.
He looked sideways at me. Do you know much about me? No. Mandy had never said anything. What do you know?
I know you can imitate people just as Lady Eleanor could. Once you imitated your manservant to his face, and he wasn't sure whether he was the servant or you were. You make up your own fairy tales, and you drop things and trip over things. I know you once broke a whole set of dishes.
I slipped on ice.
Ice chips you spilled before you slipped on them.
He laughed. It wasn't a ridiculing laugh. It was a happy laugh at a good joke. An accident, I protested. But I smiled too, tremblingly, after so much crying. We reached Father, who bowed.
Thank you, Highness, for accompanying my daughter.
Char returned the bow.
Come, Eleanor, Father said.
Eleanor. No one had ever called me that before, even though it was my real name. Eleanor had always been Mother, and always would be. Ella, I'm Ella, I said.
Ella, then. Come, Ella.
He bowed to Prince Charmont and climbed into the carriage. I had to go. Char handed me in. I didn't know whether to give him my hand or let him push up on my elbow. He wound up with the middle of my arm, and I had to grasp the side of the carriage with the other hand for balance. When he closed the door, I caught my skirt, and there was a loud ripping sound. Father winced. I saw Char through the window, laughing again. I turned the skirt and found a gash about 6 inches above the hem. Bertha would never be able to make it smooth. I arranged myself as far from Father as possible. He was staring out the window.
A fine affair. All of Frel came. Everyone who counts, anyway, he said,
as though Mother's funeral had been a tournament or a ball. It wasn't fine. It was awful, I said. How could Mother's funeral be fine?
The prince was friendly to you.
He liked Mother.
Your mother was beautiful.
His voice was regretful. I'm sorry she's dead. Nathan flicked his whip, and the carriage began to move. Chapter 3. When we reached the manor, Father ordered me to change into something clean and to hurry down to greet the guests who were arriving to pay their respects. My room was peaceful. Everything was just as it had been before Mother died. The birds embroidered into the coverlet on my bed were safe in their world of cross-stitched leaves. My diary was on the dresser. The friends of my childhood, Flora, the rag doll, and Rosamund, the wooden doll in the gown with 7 flounces, nestled in their basket. I sat on the bed, fighting my need to obey Father's order to change and go back downstairs. Although I wanted to draw comfort from my room, from my bed, from the light breeze coming through my window, I kept thinking instead of Father and getting dressed. Once I had overheard Bertha tell Mandy that he was only a person on the outside, and that his insides were ashes mixed with coins and a brain. But Mandy had disagreed. "He's human through and through. No other creature would be as selfish as he is, not fairies or gnomes or elves or giants." For a full 3 minutes I delayed getting dressed. It was a terrible game I'd played, trying to break my curse, seeing how long I could last against the need to do what I had been told. There was a buzzing in my ears, and the floor seemed to tilt so far that I feared I would slide off the bed. I hugged my pillow until my arms hurt, as if the pillow were an anchor against following orders. In a second, I was going to fly apart into a thousand pieces. I stood and walked to my wardrobe. Immediately, I felt perfectly fine. Although I suspected Father wanted me to wear another morning gown, I put on the frock Mother liked best. She said the spicy green brought out my eyes. I thought I looked like a grasshopper in it, a skinny, spiky grasshopper with a human head and straight hair. But at least the gown wasn't black. She hated black clothing. The great hall was full of people in black. Father came to me instantly.
"Here's my lass, young Eleanor," he said loudly.
He led me in, whispering, "You look like a weed in that gown. You're supposed to be in mourning. They'll think you have no respect for your..." I was engulfed from behind by two chubby arms encased in rustling black satin.
"My poor child, we feel for you." The voice was syrupy. "And Sir Peter, it's dreadful to see you on such a tragic occasion."
An extra tight squeeze and I was released. The speaker was a tall, plump lady, with long and wavy, honey-colored tresses. Her face was a pasty white, with twin spots of rouge on the cheeks. With her were two smaller versions of herself, but without the rouge. The younger one also lacked her mother's abundant hair. Instead, she had thin curls stuck tight to her scalp, as though glued there.
"This is Dame Olga," Father said, touching the tall lady's arm.
I curtsied and knocked into the younger girl. "Beg pardon," I said. She didn't answer, didn't move, only watched me. Father continued,
"Are these your lovely daughters?"
"They are my treasures. This is Hattie, and this is Olive. They are off to finishing school in a few days." Hattie was older than I, by about 2 years.
"Delighted to make your acquaintance," she said, smiling and showing large front teeth.
She held her hand out to me as though she expected me to kiss it or bow over it. I stared, uncertain what to do. She lowered her arm, but continued to smile. Olive was the one I'd bumped.
"I'm glad to meet you," she said, her voice too loud.
She was about my age. The furrows of a frown were permanently etched between her eyes.
"Comfort Eleanor in her grief," Dame Olga told her daughters. "I want to talk with Sir Peter."
She took Father's arm, and they left us.
"Our hearts weep for you," Hattie began. "When you bellowed at the funeral, I thought, what a poor thing you are."
"Green isn't a mourning color," Olive said.
Hattie surveyed the room.
"This is a fine hall, almost as fine as the palace, where I'm going to live some day. Our mother, Dame Olga, says your father is very rich. She says he can make money out of anything."
"Out of a toenail," Olive suggested.
"Our mother, Dame Olga, says your father was poor when he married your mother. Our mother says Lady Eleanor was rich when they got married, but your father made her richer."
"We're rich, too," Olive said. "We're lucky to be rich."
"Would you show us the rest of the manor?" Hattie asked.
We went upstairs, and Hattie had to look everywhere. She opened the wardrobe in Mother's room, and before I could stop her, ran her hands over Mother's gowns. When we got back to the hall, she announced,
42 windows and a fireplace in every room. The windows must have cost a trunk full of gold KJs.
"Do you want to know about our manor?" Olive asked.
I didn't care if they lived in a hollow log. "You'll have to visit us and see for yourself,"
Hattie said in response to my silence. We stood near the side table, which was loaded with mountains of food, from a whole roast heart with ivy threaded through its antlers to butter cookies as small and lacy as snowflakes. I wondered how Mandy had had time to cook it all. "Would you like something to eat?"
"Yeah,"
Olive began, but her sister interrupted firmly.
"Oh, no. No, thank you. We never eat at parties. The excitement quite takes away our appetites.
My appetite, Olive tried again.
Our appetites are small. Mother worries. But it looks delicious.
Hattie edged toward the food.
Quail eggs are such a delicacy. 10 brass cages apiece. Olive, there are 50 at least.
More quail eggs than windows.
I like gooseberry tarts, Olive said.
Oh, we mustn't, Hattie said. Well, maybe a little.
A giant couldn't eat half a leg of deer, plus a huge mound of wild rice, and 8 of the 50 quail eggs and go back for dessert. But Hattie could. Olive ate even more. Gooseberry tarts, and currant bread, and cream trifle, and plum pudding, and chocolate bonbons, and spice cake, all dribbled over with butter rum sauce, and apricot sauce, and peppermint sauce. They brought their plates close to their faces, so their forks had the shortest possible distance to travel. Olive ate steadily, but Hattie put her fork down every so often to pat her mouth daintily with her napkin. Then she'd tuck in again, as avidly as ever. It was disgusting to watch. I looked down at a throw rug that used to lie under Mother's chair. Today it had been moved near the food. I had never concentrated on it before. A hound and hunters chased a boar toward a fringe of scarlet wool. As I stared, I saw movement. Winds stirred the grass by the boar's feet. I blinked and the movement stopped. I stared again and it started again. The dog had just bayed. I felt his throat relax. One of the hunters limped, and I felt a cramp in his calf. The boar gasped for breath and ran on fear and rage. "What are you looking at?" Olive asked. She had finished eating.
I started. I felt as if I'd been in the rug. Nothing, just the carpet. I glanced at the rug again. An ordinary carpet with an ordinary design.
Your eyes were popping out.
They looked like an ogre's eyes, Hattie said. Buggy. But there, you look more normal now.
She never looked normal. She looked like a rabbit. A fat one. The kind Mandy liked to slaughter for stew. And Olive's face was as blank as a peeled potato.
I don't suppose your eyes ever pop out, I said.
I don't think so, Hattie smiled complacently. They're too small to pop.
The smile remained, but now it seemed pasted on. I forgive you, child. We in the peerage are forgiving. Your poor mother used to be known for her ill-breeding, too.
Mother used to be known. The past tense froze my tongue. Girls! Dame Olga bore down on us. We must be going! She hugged me, and my nose filled with the stink of spoiled milk.
They left. Father was outside at the iron gate, saying goodbye to the rest of the guests. I went to Mandy in the kitchen. She was piling up dirty dishes.
Seems like those people didn't eat for a week.
I put on an apron and pumped water into the sink. They never tasted your food before. Mandy's cooking was better than anybody else's. Mother and I used to try her recipes sometimes. We'd follow the instructions exactly, and the dish would be delicious, but never as wonderful as when Mandy cooked it. Somehow, it reminded me of the rug. The carpet in the hall with the hunters and the boar, you know the one. Something funny happened to me when I looked at it before.
Oh, that silly thing. You shouldn't pay attention to that old rug.
She turned to stir a pot of soup.
What do you mean? It's just a fairy joke.
A fairy rug? How do you know?
It belonged to Lady.
Mandy always called Mother Lady. That wasn't an answer. Did my fairy godmother give it to her?
A long time ago.
Did Mother ever tell you who my fairy godmother is?
No, she didn't. Where's your father?
He's outside saying goodbye. Do you know anyway, even though she never told you?
Know what?
Who my fairy godmother is.
If she'd wanted you to know, your mother would have told you.
She was going to. She promised. Please tell Mandy.
I am.
You are not telling. Who is it?
Me. Your fairy godmother is me. Here, taste the carrot soup. It's for dinner. How is it?
Chapter 4. My mouth opened automatically.
The spoon descended and the hot but not burning swallow poured in. Manny had gotten the carrots at their sweetest, carrotiest best. Weaving in and out of the carrots were other flavors. Lemon, turtle broth, and a spice I couldn't name. The best carrot soup in the world. Magical soup that nobody but Mandy could make. The rug, the soup, this was fairy soup. Mandy was a fairy. But if Mandy was a fairy, why was Mother dead?
You're not a fairy.
Why not?
If you were, you would have saved her.
Oh, sweetie, I would have if I could. If she'd left the hair in my curing soup, she'd be well today.
You knew. Why did you let her?
I didn't know till she was too sick. We can't stop dying.
I collapsed on the stool next to the stove, sobbing so hard I couldn't catch my breath. Then Mandy's arms were around me, and I was crying into the ruffles along the neck of her apron, where I had cried so many times before for smaller reasons. A drop landed on my finger. Mandy was crying, too. Her face was red and blotchy.
I was her fairy godmother, too, Mandy said. And your grandmother's.
She blew her nose. I pushed out of Mandy's arms for a new look at her. She couldn't be a fairy. Fairies were thin and young and beautiful. Mandy was as tall as a fairy was supposed to be, but whoever heard of a fairy with frizzy gray hair and two chins?
Show me, I demanded.
Show you what?
That you're a fairy. Disappear or something. I don't have to show you anything. And, with the exception of Lucinda, fairies never disappear when other creatures are present.
Can you?
We can, but we don't. Lucinda is the only one who's rude enough and stupid enough.
Why is it stupid?
Because it lets people know you're a fairy.
She started to wash the dishes.
Help me.
Do Nathan and Bertha know? I carried plates to the sink.
Know what?
You're a fairy.
Oh, that again. No one knows but you. And you'd better keep it a secret.
Mandy looked her fiercest.
Why?
She just scowled. I will. I promise. But why?
I'll tell you. People only like the idea of fairies. When they bump up against a particular real as corn fairy, there's always trouble.
She rinsed a platter.
You dry.
Why?
Because the dishes are wet, that's why.
She saw my surprised face.
Oh, why is there trouble? Two reasons, mostly. People know we can do magic, so they want us to solve their problems for them. When we don't, they get mad. The other reason is we're immortal. That gets them mad, too. Lady wouldn't speak to me for a week when her father died.
Why doesn't Lucinda care if people know she's a fairy?
She likes them to know, the fool. She wants them to thank her when she gives them one of her awful gifts.
Are they always awful?
Always. They are always awful. But some people are delighted to have a present from a fairy, even if it makes them miserable.
Why did Mother know you're a fairy? Why do I know?
All the Eleanor line are friends of the fairies. You have fairy blood in you.
Fairy blood? Can I do magic? Shall I live forever? Would Mother have if she hadn't gotten sick? Are there many friends of the fairies?
Very few. You're the only one left in Curia. And no, love, you can't do magic or live forever. It's just a drop of fairy blood. But there's one way it has already started to show. Your feet haven't grown for a few years, I'll warrant.
None of me has grown for a few years.
The rest of you will soon enough, but you'll have fairy feet like your mother did.
Mandy lifted the hems of her skirt and five petticoats to reveal feet that were no longer than mine.
We're too tall for our feet. It's the only thing we can't change by magic. Our men stuff their shoes so no one can tell, and we ladies hide them under our skirts.
I stuck a foot out of my gown. Tiny feet were fashionable, but would they make me even clumsier as I grew taller? Would I be able to keep my balance?
Could you make my feet grow if you wanted to? Or,
I searched for another miracle. Rain pelted the window.
Or could you stop the rain?
Mandy nodded.
Do it, please do it. Why would I want to?
For me. I want to see magic, big magic.
We don't do big magic. Lucinda's the only one. It's too dangerous.
What's dangerous about ending a storm?
Maybe nothing. Maybe something. Use your imagination.
Clear skies would be good. People could go outside.
Use your imagination, Mandy repeated.
I thought, the grass needs rain. The crops need rain.
More, Mandy said.
Maybe a bandit was going to rob someone, and he isn't doing it because of the weather.
That's right. Or maybe I'd start a drought, and then I'd have to fix that because I started it. And then maybe the rain I sent would knock down a branch and smash in the roof of a house. And I'd have to fix that, too.
That wouldn't be your fault. The owner should have built a stronger roof.
Maybe. Maybe not. Or maybe I'd cause a flood and people would be killed. That's the problem with big magic. I only do little magic. Good cooking, my curing soup, my tonic.
When Lucinda cast the spell on me, was that big magic?
Of course it was, the numbskull.
Mandy scoured a pot so hard that it clattered and banged against the copper sink. Tell me how to break the spell, please, Mandy.
I don't know how. I only know it can be done.
If I told Lucinda how terrible it is, would she lift the spell, do you think?
I doubt it, but maybe. Then again, she might take away one spell and give you another even worse. The trouble with Lucinda is ideas pop into her head and come out as spells.
What does she look like?
Not like the rest of us, but you'd better hope you never lay eyes on her.
Where does she live? I asked. If I could find her, maybe I could persuade her to lift my curse. After all, Mandy could be wrong.
We're not on speaking terms. I don't keep track of the whereabouts of Lucinda, the idiot. Watch that bull.
The order came too late. I got the broom. Are all friends clumsy?
No, sweet. Fairy blood does not make you clumsy. That's human. You don't see me dropping plates, do you?
I started to sweep, but it wasn't necessary. The pieces of pottery gathered themselves together and flew into the trash bin. I couldn't believe it!
That's about all I do, honey. Small magic that can't hurt anybody. Handy sometimes, though. No sharp bits left on the floor.
I stared into the bin. The shards lay there. Why didn't you turn it back into a bowl?
The magic's too big. Doesn't seem like it, but it is. Could hurt someone. You never know.
You mean fairies can't see the future? If you could, you'd know, wouldn't you?
We can't see the future any more than you can. Only gnomes can. A few of them, anyway.
A bell tinkled somewhere in the house. Father calling one of the servants. Mother never used the bell. Were you my great-grandmother's fairy godmother, too? 1,000 questions flooded in. How long have you been our fairy godmother? How old was Mandy, really? Bertha came in.
Sir Peter wants you in the study, miss.
What does he want? I asked.
He didn't say.
She twisted one of her braids, anxiously. Bertha was scared of everything. What was there to be afraid of? My father wanted to talk to me. It was only to be expected. I finished drying a plate, dried another, then a third.
"Best not tarry, little mistress," Bertha said.
I reached for a fourth dish.
"You'd better go," Mandy said, "and he won't want to see that apron."
Mandy was frightened, too. I took off the apron and left. I stopped just within the doorway of the study. Father sat in Mother's chair, examining something in his lap.
"Ah, there you are," he looked up. "Come closer, Ella."
I glared at him, resenting the order. Then I took one step forward. It was the game I played with Mandy, obedience and defiance.
"I asked you to come closer, Eleanor."
I came closer.
"Not near enough. I won't bite you. I only want to get to know you a bit."
He walked to me and led me to a chair facing him.
"Have you ever seen anything as splendid as this?"
He passed me the object he'd had in his lap.
"You can hold it. It's heavy for its size. Here."
I decided to drop it, since he liked it so much. But I glanced at it first, and then I couldn't. I held a porcelain castle, no bigger than my two fists, with 6 wee towers, each ending in a miniature candle holder. And oh, strung between a window in each of 2 towers was a gossamer thread of china, from which hung laundry. A man's hose, a robe, a baby's pinafore, all thin as a spider's web. And, painted in a window downstairs, a smiling maiden waved a silken scarf.
It seemed to be silk anyway.
Father took it from me.
Close your eyes.
I heard him pull the heavy drapes shut. I watched through slitted eyes. I didn't trust him. He placed the castle on the mantel, put in candles, and lit them.
Open your eyes.
I ran to look closer. The castle was a sparkling wonderland. The flames drew pearly tints out of the white walls, and the windows glowed yellow gold, suggesting cheerful fires within.
Oh, I said.
Father opened the drapes and blew out the candles.
Lovely, isn't it?
I nodded. Where did you get it?
From the elves. An elf made it. They're marvelous potters. One of Agulon's students made this. I've always wanted an Agulon, but I haven't gotten it yet.
Where will you put it?
Where do you want me to put it, Ella?
In a window.
Not in your room?
In any room, but in a window. So it could wink out at everyone, inside and on the street. Father stared at me for a long moment.
I shall tell its buyer to place it in a window.
You're going to sell it?
I'm a merchant, Ella. I sell things.
For a minute, he spoke to himself.
And perhaps I can pass this one off as a genuine Agulon. Who could tell?
He came back to me.
Now you know who I am. Sir Peter the Merchant. But who are you?
A daughter who used to have a mother.
He waved that aside. But who is Ella?
A lass who doesn't wish to be interrogated. He was pleased.
You have courage to speak to me so.
He looked me over.
That's my chin.
He touched it, and I drew back.
Strong, determined. That's my nose. I hope you don't mind that the nostrils flare. My eyes, except yours, are green. Most of your face belongs to me. I wonder how it will be on a woman when you grow up.
Why did he think it was fine to talk about me as though I were a portrait instead of a maiden?
What shall I do with you? He asked himself.
Why must you do something with me?
I can't leave you to grow up a cook's helper. You must be educated.
He changed the subject.
What did you think of Dame Olga's daughters?
They were not comforting, I said. Father laughed.
Really laughed, head back, shoulders heaving.
What was so funny? I disliked being laughed at. It made me want to say something nice about the loathsome Hattie and Olive. They meant well, I suppose.
Father wiped tears from his eyes. They didn't mean well. The older one is an unpleasant conniver like her mother, and the younger one is a simpleton. It never entered their heads to mean well.
His voice became thoughtful.
Dame Olga is titled and rich.
What did that have to do with anything?
Perhaps I should send you to finishing school with her daughters. You might learn how to walk like the slip of a thing you are, not like a small elephant.
Finishing school? I'd have to leave Mandy. And they'd tell me what to do all the time, and I'd have to do it, whatever it was. They'd try to rid me of my clumsiness, but they wouldn't be able to. So they'd punish me, and I'd punish them back. And they'd punish me more. Why can't I just stay here?
I suppose you could be taught by a governess, if I could find someone.
I would much rather have a governess, Father. I would study very hard if I had a governess.
But not otherwise?
His eyebrows rose, but I could tell he was amused. He stood and went to the desk where Mother used to work out our household accounts.
You may go now. I have work to do.
I left. On my way out, I said, Perhaps small elephants cannot be admitted to finishing school. Perhaps small elephants cannot be finished. Perhaps they... I stopped. He was laughing again.
Chapter 5. The next night I had to dine with Father. I had trouble sitting down at the table because Bertha had made me wear a fashionable gown, and my petticoat was voluminous. On Father's plate and mine was sparrowgrass covered with a tarragon mustard sauce. In front of his plate was a many-faceted crystal goblet. When I finally managed to settle in my chair, Father signaled to Nathan to pour wine into the goblet.
See how it catches the light, Eleanor?
He raised it.
It makes the wine sparkle like a garnet.
It's pretty.
Is that all? Just pretty?
It's very pretty, I suppose. I refused to love it.
He was going to sell it, too.
You may appreciate it more if you drink from it. Have you ever tasted wine?
Mandy never let me. I reached for the goblet and trailed my balloon sleeve through the sparrowgrass sauce. But the goblet was too far away. I had to stand. I stood on my skirts and lost my balance, pitching forward. To stop my fall, I brought my arm crashing down on the table and knocked into Father's elbow. He dropped the goblet. It fell and broke neatly into two pieces, stem severed from body. A red stain spread across the tablecloth, and Father's doublet was dotted with wine. I steeled myself for his rage, but he surprised me.
That was stupid of me, he said,
dabbing at his clothes with a napkin.
When you came in, I saw you couldn't manage yourself.
Nathan and a serving maid whisked away the tablecloth and broken glass. I apologize, I said.
That won't put the crystal back together, will it? He snapped,
then collected himself.
Your apology is accepted. We will both change our clothes and begin our meal.
I returned in a quarter hour in an everyday gown.
It is my fault, Father said, cutting into a sparrowgrass spear. I've let you grow up an oaf.
I'm not an oaf. Mandy wasn't one to mince words, and she'd never called me that. Clumsy, bumbling, gawky, but never an oaf. Blunderer, lumpkin, fumblefoot, but never an oaf.
But you're young enough to learn, Father went on. Someday, I may want to take you into civilized company.
I don't like civilized company.
I may need civilized company to like you. I've made up my mind. It's off to finishing school with you.
I couldn't go. I wouldn't. You said I could have a governess. Wouldn't that be less expensive than sending me away? A serving maid whisked away my uneaten sparrowgrass and replaced it with scallops and tomato aspic.
How kind of you to worry. A governess would be much more expensive, and I haven't the time to interview governesses. In 2 days, you shall go to finishing school with Dame Olga's daughters.
I won't! He continued as though I hadn't spoken.
I'll write a letter to the headmistress, which I shall entrust to you, along with a purse filled with enough KJs to stop her protests against a last-minute pupil.
I won't go! You shall do as I say, Eleanor. I won't go!
Ella!
He bit into a scallop and spoke while he chewed.
Your father is not a good man, as the servants have already warned you, unless I miss my guess.
I didn't deny it.
They may have said I'm selfish, and I am. They may have said I'm impatient, and I am. They may have said I always have my way, and I do.
I do, too, I lied. He grinned at me admiringly.
My daughter is the bravest wench in Kyria.
The smile vanished, and his mouth tightened into a hard, thin line. But she shall go to finishing school if I have to take her there myself, and it will not be a pleasant trip if I have to lose time from my training because of you. Do you understand, Ella? Angry, Father reminded me of a carnival toy, a leather fist attached to a coiled spring used in puppet shows. When the spring was released, the fist shot out at a hapless puppet. With Father, it wasn't the fist that frightened me. It was the spring, because the spring determined the force of the blow. The anger in his eyes was so tightly coiled that I didn't know what would happen if his spring were tripped. I hated being frightened, but I was. I'll go to finishing school, I couldn't help adding, but I shall loathe it. His grin was back.
You are free to loathe or to love, so long as you go.
It was a taste of obedience without an order, and I didn't like it any better than the Lucinda-induced kind. I left the dining room, and he didn't stop me. It was early evening. In spite of the hour, I went up to my room and donned my nightgown. Then I moved my dolls, Flora and Rosamund, into bed and climbed in. They had stopped sleeping with me years before, but tonight I needed special comfort. I gathered them on my stomach and waited for sleep, but sleep was busy elsewhere. Tears started. I pushed Flora against my face.
Sweetie.
The door opened. It was Mandy with tonic and a box. I felt bad enough. No tonic, Mandy. I'm fine, truly.
Oh, lovey.
She put down the tonic and the box and held me, stroking my forehead. I don't want to go, I said into her shoulder.
I know, honey, she said.
She held me for a long while, until I was almost asleep. Then she shifted her weight.
Tonic time.
I'll skip tonight.
No, you won't. Not tonight especially. I won't have you getting sick when you need your strength.
A spoon came out of her apron.
Take it. 3 spoons.
I braced myself. Tonic tasted nutty and good, but it felt slimy, like swallowing a frog. Each spoonful oozed along my throat. I continued to gulp after it was down to rid myself of the sensation. But it made me feel better. A little better. Ready to talk, anyway. I settled myself back in Mandy's lap. Why did Mother marry him? This question had troubled me since I was old enough to think about it. Until she was his wife, Sir Peter was very sweet to Lady. I didn't trust him, but she wouldn't listen to me. Her family didn't approve because he was poor, which made Lady want him even more. She was that kind-hearted. Mandy's hand stopped its comforting journey up and down my forehead.
Ella, pet, try to keep him from learning about the spell on you.
Why? What would he do?
He likes to have his way too much. He'd use you.
Mother ordered me not to tell about the curse, but I wouldn't anyway.
That's right.
Her hand went back to work on my forehead. I closed my eyes. What will it be like, do you think?
At school? Some of the lasses will be lovely.
Sit up, sweet. Don't you want your presents? I had forgotten about the box. But there had been only one. Presents?
One at a time.
Mandy handed me the box I'd seen.
For you. Wherever you go, your whole life.
Inside the box was a book of fairy tales. I had never seen such beautiful illustrations. They were almost alive. I turned the pages, marveling.
When you look at it, you can remember me and take comfort.
I'll save it until I leave, so the stories will be new. Mandy chuckled.
You won't finish it so fast. It grows on you.
She fished in the pocket of her apron and fetched out a tissue paper packet.
From Lady. She would have wanted you to have it.
It was Mother's necklace. Threads of silver ended almost at my waist, in a woven pattern of silver studded with tiny pearls.
You'll grow into it, sweet, and look as lovely wearing it as your mother did.
I'll wear it always.
You'd be wise to keep it under your gown when you go out. It's that valuable. Gnomes made it.
The bell tinkled downstairs.
That father of yours is ringing.
I hugged Mandy and clung to her. She disentangled herself from my arms.
Let me go, love.
Planting a kiss on my cheek, she laughed. I settled back into bed, and this time, sleep claimed me. Chapter 6. The next morning, I woke with my fingers curled around Mother's necklace. The clock in King Gerald's palace was just striking 6. Perfect. I wanted to rise early and spend the day saying goodbye to the places I loved best. I put my gown over the necklace and crept down to the pantry, where I found a tray of freshly baked scones. They were hot, so I tossed 2 in the air and caught them in my skirt, pulling it out to make a basket. Then, looking down at my breakfast, I ran to the front of the house and right into Father. He was in the entranceway, waiting for Nathan to bring the carriage around.
I don't have time for you now, Eleanor. Run off and bang into somebody else. And tell Mandy I'll be back with the bailiff. We'll need lunch.
As instructed, I ran off. Aside from its dangerous aspects, the curse often made a fool of me and was partly the reason I seemed so clumsy. Now I had to bang into someone. Bertha was carrying wet laundry. When I bumped into her, she dropped her basket. My gowns and stockings and undergarments tumbled onto the tiles. I helped her pick them up, but she was going to have to wash everything over again.
Little mistress, it's hard enough getting your things ready so quickly without having to do it twice, she scolded.
After I apologized, and after I delivered Father's message to Mandy, and after she made me sit down and eat breakfast on a plate, I started for the royal menagerie just outside the walls of the king's palace. My favorite exhibits were the talking birds and the exotic animals. Except for the hydra in her swamp and the baby dragon, the exotics, the unicorn, the herd of centaurs, and the griffin family, lived on an island meadow surrounded by an extension of the castle moat. The dragon was kept in an iron cage.
He was beautiful in his tiny ferocity, his ruby eyes gleaming evilly. I bought a morsel of yellow cheese from the stand next to the cage and toasted it in the fire, which was a tricky business, getting close enough for cooking, but not so close that the dragon got the treat. I wondered what King Gerald planned to do with him when he grew up. I wondered also whether I would be home to learn his fate. Beyond the dragon, a centaur stood near the moat, gazing at me. Did centaurs like cheese? I walked toward him quietly, hoping he wouldn't gallop off. "Here," a voice said. I turned. It was Prince Charmant, offering me an apple. "Thank you." Holding out my hand, I edged closer to the moat. The centaur's nostrils flared, and he trotted toward me. I tossed the apple. Two other centaurs galloped over, but mine caught the treat and started eating, crunching loudly. I always expect them to thank me or say, "How dare you stare," I said. "They are not smart enough to talk. See how blank their eyes are?" he pointed, teaching me. I knew all that, but perhaps it was a princely duty to explain matters to one's subjects. "If they had words," I said, "they wouldn't be able to think of anything to say." A surprised silence followed. Then Char laughed. "That's funny. You're funny. As the Lady Eleanor was." He looked stricken. "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to remind you." "I think of her often," I said. "Most of the time." We walked along the edge of the moat. "Would you like an apple, too?" He held out another one. I wanted to make him laugh again. I pawed the ground with my right foot and tossed my head as though I had a mane. Opening my eyes as wide as they'd go, I stared stupidly at Char and took the apple. He did laugh. Then he made an announcement. "I like you. I'm quite taken with you." He took a third apple for himself out of the pocket of his cape. I liked him, too. He wasn't haughty or disdainful or stuffy as the High Chancellor Thomas was. All the Kyrians bowed when we passed, and the visiting elves and gnomes did, too. I didn't know how to respond, but Char raised his arm each time, bent at the elbow in the customary royal salute. It was habit,